Welcome on to another edition of the Dunked on Basketball podcast. We talked about this a couple weeks ago to start doing some deep dives into teams, kind of like we did with the season preview series, and check in on where some of these teams are. And I thought that maybe one of the best places to start was with one of the best beat writers out there and one of the surprise teams of the year, the New York Knicks, and Chris Herring of the Wall Street Journal. What's up, Chris?
Not much, man. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Maybe not as well as you are. I mean, the comparison between last year, which might have been like the most desultory team to cover, and this year where you have Porzingis and they're playing well and there's all this stuff going on, must be like a pretty stark one for you.
Yeah, no, it's way more enjoyable. You know, I always say this whenever I'm doing interviews for people that don't know my work. I don't care one way or the other whether the Knicks win or not. I'm not a fan. I've never really been a fan. And it's not my job to be a fan. I'm just supposed to be neutral. But I don't think anyone enjoys, you know, watching a 17-win team. And not even just that, because if it was a 17-win team that had some sort of upside, there'd be that. But, you know, to basically not know what was going to come of that and to watch it turn into Porzingis and now see the fruits of that tanking, I guess, if you could put it that way. It's way more enjoyable to watch them actually be building towards something and to potentially have a good team in the next couple of years. And so it's way, way more enjoyable, even if they don't make the playoffs. If they didn't win another game this year, it's already been a much more enjoyable year than what last year was.
Right. The Wolves won less games than the Knicks last year, but they're much more interesting because they had Wiggins, they had Levine, they at least had somebody who you could watch grow, you think would be part of the future. And as it turned out, actually, guys like Lance Thomas and Langston Galloway actually kind of look like they might be a little bit a part of the Knicks' future, but still not guys with star potential. So the Knicks now 22-25. They lost three straight now, right?
Yeah, they were at 500. Now they're 300.
Well, how good is this team? Do you think that they can make the playoffs as presently constructed?
I think they could, but the reason I've been down on them since the start in terms of whether I thought they'd be a playoff team. I had them at 31 wins to start the season. They're on pace for more than that, obviously. But the question that I had after their first half, where, like you said, they were right there, right around 500 at the midway point, was they've been really, really healthy. And they have a bunch of guys on the roster, not a bunch, but maybe four or five, that all miss between 10, 15, some 20 games a year. With different stuff, you know, from year to year. You look at Lopez, he's like that. Melo has become a player like that where he misses, you know, a good 10, 15 games a year with injuries. Calderon has had those sorts of issues. Aflalo missed that sort of time to start the season. And so they really were pretty healthy the first half of the season. And now already you're starting to see, you know, Melo's missed a couple games in a row here now. And, you know, Cleanthony early, end of the rotation guy who wasn't playing much. Obviously, something happened with him with the shooting and the robbery. But you're starting to hear little aches and pains come up in the injury report. Lance Thomas missed some time. Porzingis himself has had some aches and pains that he's played through. And so I just kind of wonder if that at some point that's going to catch up with them. And if it does, it's not a team with a whole lot of depth to be able to sustain the winning that they've had so far, especially if it's Carmelo that's missing time. Now they're 0-5 without him, and I think you see – them really missing something in fourth quarters of those games when he's not able to play.
Let's take a quick break here to tell you about the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked on Basketball podcast, SeatGeek. And they've been advertising for quite a while on the show, but you're really going to want to listen this week because they have a special Super Bowl offer. All my listeners usually get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase when you use the code CAPSPACE. But if you buy your Super Bowl tickets on SeatGeek, after entering that promo code, SeatGeek will send you $100, $100 back if you use the promo code CAPSPACE on SeatGeek to buy Super Bowl tickets. Now, of course, SeatGeek is great for all kinds of tickets, not even sports, also concerts, really anything else that has tickets. SeatGeek works for it because they aggregate all of the ticket buying sites together in one place. You don't have to worry about, oh man, I missed out. I didn't check this site and maybe I'm not getting the best deal. No worries about that anymore. SeatGeek's got you now, and it's also an app that's very easy to download. A couple of swipes, and you've bought your tickets. No having to enter in those squiggly lines for CAPTCHA or anything else like that. It's just all right at your fingertips, very easy to deal with. And what's more, you can sell your tickets on SeatGeek. It's obviously an awesome product for buying tickets. That's the same reason you'd want to sell your tickets there, because you're going to get in touch with more people and you'll make a lot of money selling your tickets. You'll save a lot of money buying your tickets. And we will stay on the air because you use that CatSpace code and let them know that you came from us. Everybody wins when you use SeatGeek, and especially if you buy your Super Bowl tickets, you're going to get that $100 off. Yeah, down, it was pretty ugly down the stretch, although they played well overall offensively yesterday against the Thunder with the Aflalo iso ball offense. Yeah, right now their odds are 13% on 538's playoff odds projections, and then ESPN's BPI has them at about 7%. And I think that's probably about somewhere in that range is about where I would see them, especially now having lost these three straight. Maybe when they got to 500, you might have thought it was going to be a little bit better. What are the major weaknesses on this team right now that are preventing them from really being higher in that conversation, other than the health issue that you mentioned?
I think it, well, let me not define it to just him. I was going to say it starts with a Cal and ends with Derone, but obviously the point guard situation, you know, all day Twitter's just been lighting up with the Jeff Teague talk and the trade talk, because Knicks fans have wanted to see a trade there since probably the first week of the season. Maybe not the first week, because obviously there was no trading at that point, but more than anything, people wanted Galloway or Grant to start. They didn't think Calderon was worthy of being the starter again. He picked it up a little bit, but the thing that even if he's playing at his best, that you know he's not really going to do all that well is defend. He just isn't built to defend well against today's point guard. And so when he's not playing particularly well on offense, and, you know, fans are really, really upset with him about the fact that he seems to kind of miss Porzingis a lot of the time. Porzingis is open so often because of how hard he runs down the floor, because of how big a target he is. And it seems like Calderon misses him a lot of the time or throws lazy passes. But if he's not playing well offensively, if he's not knocking down shots at a consistent rate or getting off his shot, which is a problem for him too.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing for him.
He's a great shooter. He can't turn the corner on anybody in a pick and roll. He probably takes more shot fakes per game than he does actual shots. So that's the issue, is that he's a good enough shooter, but he can't create his own shot, and someone has to play him open. So if he can't do those things, and then he's also not defending, why is he playing? And that's the biggest weakness. And it's not just him. That's why I said I didn't want to define it to just him, although I know I spent about a minute and a half discussing him. Aflalo's not very good defensively anymore either. He shows effort. I think Calderon shows effort too. But it's got to be – I mean, I don't watch every team in the league frequently by any means, but just watching other teams, they've got to have the slowest backcourt in the league, you know, especially – when you consider both sides of the floor, because neither one of those two guys is like a real big driver. Aflalo will go to the basket a couple times a game, but a lot of times that comes through post-ups, not so much him just straight-line drives or dribbling right past somebody. So the backcourt is a problem, because, you know, now you've got Porzingis and you've still got Melo there. Your frontcourt looks good. You know, you've got Lopez, and I think that's one of the better frontcourts in the league, you know, for probably the next 2-3 years. But the backcourt, you know, it feels like it could just fall apart at any time. Aflalo is so inconsistent. I've written about how he's one of the more inconsistent players in the league and how the Knicks' chances of winning swing really wildly based on how he's playing. I think there's something like 17-2 when he's a plus for the night, and then there's something like 1-19 when he's a minus, or maybe 1-20 when he's a minus.
And that's, you know, with him, he shoots a lot of long twos. You're going to have a lot of variability when that's your game, when you're not getting to the foul line a ton, when you're not getting to the basket. You know, sometimes those shots are going to go down for you, and other times that they're not. You mentioned the backcourt, and there are a lot of kind of pushing and pulling factors with this team that I see. And the way that they're going to play offense is a big one of them, right? I mean, you have Porzingis, a guy who with similar skills to Dirk Nowitzki in the pick and pop, he might even have a little bit more range as far as like his ability to shoot really long threes than Dirk did. And ideally, what you would think conventionally you want with that is you saw the success that Dirk had playing with guys who could score off the pick and roll, Jason Terry, one of them, and then maybe even Monte Ellis even more. You know, a small guard who can get to the basket hard off the pick and pop with Porzingis because the big has to stick to him. Now you've got a guy who you can release into the middle of the floor, go to the basket, a guard who's quick and can finish at the rim seems like the ideal partner. They don't have that guy on the roster, for one. And for two, they're sort of playing this triangle style, and I wanted to ask you, too, how much they're doing that this year. But, you know, and Porzingis has been effective sometimes in those actions where he can get a screen and get a three off going from the corner to the wing or something like that. But it seems like the triangle is not necessarily the best use of Porzingis' skills, and if you're going to build around him, you need a much more dynamic point guard who can finish at the rim.
It's not, and it's not to say I've kind of taken this position on the triangle so far because I think at times it's been fine, and generally I think you can kind of tell now when the offense is flowing well that people don't talk about it. It only really becomes an issue when they're struggling offensively and people pin it on that. And really, I'm at a point now where I'd like to take more of a wait-and-see approach. I want to see how the offense operates once they have a point guard that can actually get to the basket. Because I'm not convinced that it's a total failure of an offense anymore, because I don't think we know enough about it. We've really never seen the system run, at least not with one of Phil's teams specifically. We've never seen the system run with a really, really athletic point guard. You had Paxson and B.J. Armstrong, and you had Derek Fisher and all these guys. And even now you've got Calderon, and I feel like Calderon is really like a new age version of John Paxson. And I think even Langston Galloway is kind of like a new age version to some extent of what BJ Armstrong was. And so you have guys that really aren't, they don't really fit what today's point guard is or is supposed to be. And I think you need more, you need to really see it work. If they did have a Jeff Teague, I think it'd be really interesting to see whether that would work or not. And so, but yeah, it doesn't really fit Porzingis' skill set that well because you want him screening. You want to use how much of a threat he is as a shooter. And you normally don't do that unless they break out of the triangle or unless they run drag screens for him or if he's coming up as a trailer, you know, at the end of a play where he's able to show off his range and really make use of that threat. So it works better when Grant is on the floor with him. It also works better sometimes when he's out there and Lopez is not when he's at the five. And he gets a chance to kind of spread things out a little bit more and doesn't have to deal with the cramped spacing that they often have with the lineups with him at the four and Lopez at the five.
Yeah, they're really just within the triangle. I think its biggest flaw is that there just is not really an option for a high pick and roll to be run. And that's the play where it's just impossible to get help to the top of the key on that guy who can shoot a three if you're the big man setting the screen on that high pick and roll. So I mean, I think there are places to run the triangle where Porzingis can be effective. I don't think that he really, you know, is going to be a guy who can be that post guy on the strong side either. You know, that's in terms of like modern defense and the new rules have made it a lot harder to enter the ball there. And he's not strong enough to really avoid getting pushed out and get the angle he needs to post up there. So he's kind of limited to being really on the backside. He can turn and face and drive from there, but still, I think him with the ball at the top of the key where the big man basically never is in the triangle is the best thing for him. So we obviously had some preseason expectations. You said they're at 31 wins. That was what it was for Vegas. They're actually one of my best bets to be under, which is looking like it is quite incorrect, but you know, could still happen if there's an injury. I'm holding out hope. Just kidding, Knicks fans. So what is it about this team that has surprised you based on what your preseason expectations were?
Pretty much everybody that they signed this season, this offseason, has done well. I guess if you extend it to the draft picks, not quite. So Grant has struggled statistically. He's still been useful to them because he gives them a change of pace.
But yeah, he just can't shoot it all, right? That's his problem.
The issue is that he just can't shoot. And even then, I mean, he's... Before, he was really killing them because he couldn't shoot and wouldn't shoot. And so he was just stagnating their offense entirely. And it basically became Jaren Grant ISOs without any scoring to go with it. You're not going to draw fouls that way. He's not good enough at drawing fouls from like the mid-range area to be able to make that worth it.
Yeah. Quick tangent. I mean, what do you think of him? Can he potentially be their point guard of the future? You know, what are your thoughts on him just overall as a prospect after seeing him for 40-odd games?
Thoughts. I think he could be, but if he's going to be and they're going to keep this system long term, he's got to be able to shoot better. I just think he's not giving teams enough incentive to guard him out there. But I think he could be, and the thing is, that's kind of one of the things I'm curious about now, is whether the Knicks would include him in a deal if they didn't want to upgrade a point guard. But even if they don't, if they get someone like Teague, who's still relatively young.
Yeah, trade him to the Hawks for Jeff Teague, right? the same guy that they got with the pick from the Hawks. That'd be hilarious.
That would be a bizarre deal. But, I mean, I still cannot believe to this day that Atlanta traded for Hardaway and it gave up a pick essentially that was Grant. That's a separate issue. But I think he could be, but he looks like he's probably a year or two away. It would probably take him some real time to develop a better jump shot. And if that's the case, and they're going to keep the system, I'm not sure it would work as well as maybe what I thought it would and other people thought it would. But he's clearly got talent. He clearly can do some things that other people on their roster can't. And I think it's worth being patient with him, even if you do have a guy that maybe – is the starter for another year or two, whether that's Calcon or somebody else. I would probably be a little bit more patient with him than what it looks like there might be, because there have been nights where he's had DNPs and where they played Sasha Vujicic over him. And I've never understood that. I never thought that he was struggling that badly, because he still can play better defense than a lot of their other guards. He still can at least get something going toward the basket. But he does have flaws. He still makes a ton of jump passes and turns the ball over. He still takes some bad shots. He's obviously not a good shooter. He still gets beat defensively. The difference with him is that he's got enough athleticism sometimes to make up for his mistakes and to get into a passing lane, to get a block from behind. So he's got some real skills, and he's got some real talent. I would be patient with him for at least another 2 years, because this is what the Knicks always do. They draft someone, and then they deal him. And I think if they're not careful, they could fall into that again, because they see themselves on the cusp of the playoff race. Maybe you go get Teague or someone like that. It requires you trading Grant. And then Teague is a free agent relatively soon as well. And then you kind of fall into the same cycle that they've always been in and that you were hoping that they could finally break out of.
Yeah, Grant, quickly, shooting a mere 46% within 3 feet, which is pretty disappointing.
Right.
And only 14% from three. Overall, 44% true shooting percentage and a 9.2 PER. His competition for that backup guard spot, Vujicic, is 5.7 PER and 38% true shooting. So, not great. But you could see maybe that Grant has the athleticism. Like, he's got a lot of bounce going to the basket off of 1 foot to maybe be that pick and roll partner with Porzingis that I talked about. But that's probably enough for a non-prized rookie, Jerry and Grant. Obviously, Porzingis is another guy who's surprised. Did you see this type of rookie season coming at all? Did the Knicks internally see this type of rookie season coming at all from him?
Not to this extent. I definitely didn't see it to this extent either. A fan tweeted me at one point and said, "I think Porzingis is going to average 11-7. And I kind of laughed at him. Like, I don't think I tweeted it to the masses, but I tweeted it back to him. I was like, what are you basing that on? We see his numbers in Spain. We're watching him finish summer league. And all these are against lesser competition than what he's going to play against. And now 11-7 was lowballing it. I mean, it's pretty much at 14-8, I think, for the year.
He's been better this year in the NBA than he was in Spain last year.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
It's hard to believe, because I can't imagine too many people have done that. The minutes aren't so substantially different to explain the counting statistics. And even if they were, it's about how he's getting those numbers and the fact that he's not a ball dominant player, the fact that he does most of it within the offense, the fact that the biggest surprise, and it's funny because Derek Fisher talks in so many, curveballs and all this high-minded language sometimes. And you ask him, like, what do you think about tomorrow? He's like, there is no tomorrow. He says all this crazy, like, James Bond type stuff. And I just asked him, I said, Fish, can you just be honest with me in the sense that there's no way you could have expected him to be this? And he said, well, we don't place expectations on people because that's limiting. We don't do that. And I said, Derek, he averaged 3 rebounds a game in summer league, and now he's averaging 8. Like, are you really telling me that you expected that or that this doesn't surprise you? He's like, okay, we are a little surprised, obviously, at how good an offensive rebounder is. And so then he kind of opens up and acknowledges that, like, we didn't see this coming. And I've had, you know, private conversation with Steve Mills where he's like, we're, like, over the moon about this guy's progression because they obviously thought they got a good player. I think they figured it would take way more time to see what we're already seeing. And so if they're being honest and, you know, Fisher's being honest, they did not see this. They wanted to give him a chance to potentially win a starting position. I think they did see how talented he was defensively and his ability to move his feet and guard pick and rolls and to be a rim protector. But they clearly didn't think he'd be this good. And Derek Fisher even said, if we'd known he was this far along, we probably would have progressed with our summer plans differently in terms of the way they approach free agency and in terms of the fact that they really built a roster that doesn't fit today's small ball era. You know, it's kind of more, they've got a lot of bruisers and a lot of guys in the post where, you know, really most nights they're having them match up with teams that are smaller and quicker. And so they probably would not have made the signings that they did if they'd known that Porzingis was going to be capable of playing a lot of center this year.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And do you feel like they are better now? I mean, so we see the lineups when they close. Sometimes it will be Lopez at the 5, Porzingis at the 4 last night, and oftentimes it's been Porzingis at the 5. Which of those alignments do you like better for this year? And then also just overall for the future?
Here's my thing. I thought at the beginning of the year that the lineup that they're going to run out there, that has been their starting lineup all year, I thought it would be slow. And that's true. I think they forced the fewest turnovers of any lineup in the league, or at least of any starting lineup in the league. I think there was some element of luck, you know, and I know there have been a lot of statistics to show that 3-point defense is more based on whether you can stop teams from shooting them as opposed to what teams actually shoot on them. And that's a better, you know, metric and better gauge of how a team is defending the 3-ball. But I think, honestly, I like Porzingis and Lopez playing next to each other. I still think there are a lot of things that Lopez quietly does or, you know, behind the scenes that help Porzingis rebound better. I think.
Yeah, they can't get a rebound when Porzingis is at center. That's been very clear in the statistics so far.
Very much so. And I think that will probably continue to be true for a while. He's a really scrawny kid, and he'll put on more weight. He'll get stronger, and I'm not concerned about that. But Lopez also has kind of found a pretty nice rhythm with his offensive game in a lot of these games lately, too. What I've said before on previous podcasts and other conversations, that I'd like for them to find better ways to space the offense, and I kind of feel like sometimes, depending on who's on the court, that they still aren't in perfect position even for what they're supposed to be running. And so there are times that I like watching KP play the 5 because, one, against certain lineups, he's more than capable of playing center by himself. He's so much taller than a lot of guys. But also, just from an offensive standpoint, they're going to play lineups sometimes where you really have to pick your poison. When they play Grant and Galloway and Melo at the 4 and Porzingis at the 5 and maybe Derek Williams or Lance Thomas, everybody can shoot except for Grant. Everybody can shoot. And it's a pretty dangerous lineup. It just allows a ton of driving lanes, which they don't have very many guys on the team that can create their own shot by driving. So it's more advantageous for them to run that offensively, and they can get away with it sometimes on defense. But I think long term, there's no question that Porzingis is a 5. And I think that's one of the other things that Fisher wasn't aware of going in, and that I don't think the Knicks were aware of when you listen to them after draft day. That I asked repeatedly, do you think he's going to be able to play some 5? And Porzingis was like, I'm a power forward. And, you know, Fisher was kind of saying.
And famously, they told LaMarcus Aldridge, you're going to have to play center when you're here. And he canceled the meeting with them. You know, that shows you how that absolutely was correct, that they didn't see him as a 5 at all.
Right. So, I mean, I really think that that he's capable of doing that now. And they've made note of that, too. Fisher lately has changed the rotation a little bit to where he starts Lopez and Porzingis together, and then he will pull Porzingis maybe 5-6 minutes into the quarter, play Lopez for 2 or 3 minutes more, and then sub him out for KP and bring KP back in, so that he essentially has one of them on the floor at all times to have a true rim protector in there at all times. So at this point, lately, Porzingis has been playing probably 35 to 40% of his minutes at center anyway over the last month or so, which is a major difference from before where he's playing the majority of his minutes at the four. So I like that because I think it gets him ready for what he's going to be doing long term, whether that's because they deal Lopez, you know, a year or two from now, or just because, you know, when Lopez is gone at the end of his contract, that this is clearly where KP is going to be long term.
Yeah, and maybe I think Lopez will get to the point where he at least will be, if not a huge asset on his deal, you know, a guy who's a starting level center is making a little bit less than $15 million, and that's going to kind of be what the new paradigm is for a starter in this market, starting with the $90 million cap this summer. I want to ask you about a couple other surprises. Langston Galloway had a great rookie year last year. He's 24 now, but he's shooting 38% on threes, can defend pretty well. You know, maybe not a starting guard, but a great combo guard that you can kind of bring in off the bench. The Knicks have early bird rights on him, meaning that he's going to have a small cap hold, but then the most they can offer him is $6 million to start, although he'll also, or I'm sorry, that's true, but then he also is going to be a restricted free agent with the Arenas rule. And then Lance Thomas will be unrestricted, but same thing, the most they can offer him is about $6 million to start, unless they want to dip into their cap space for both those guys. Right. That's a long-winded way of saying, what do you see happening with those guys in the off season? You know, are the Knicks going to bring them back? What kind of contracts you think those guys could get, and how do the Knicks feel about them? Because I could very easily see them using all their cap space and then getting those guys to wait, and then kind of maybe overpaying them a little bit as a way of waiting, but then kind of hurting them their future flexibility financially after this summer.
Yeah, no, I can see that too. And it raises the interesting question also of whether, you know, I guess depending on how the Knicks approach this was how I felt this summer too, that if they did not need to swing for the absolute fences this year, it was too much of a cleanup job after last year to go for broke for Aldridge and for DeAndre Jordan. Like, I like the fact that they had backup plans basically, and that they were really, really quick and really aggressive with Lopez, to where they essentially said, look, if we don't get DeAndre Jordan, we want you here. And basically got him to agree that he would wait and that he would sign with them if DeAndre Jordan didn't come to the Knicks. So I think this is another summer where they probably need to approach it that way. You know, obviously KD is out there and you absolutely try to get a meeting with him and other people. Mike Conley is going to be out there and people like that. But if you don't get those guys, I don't think you need to make it all about this one summer. You could potentially try to go for guys the summer after that too, and save yourself some room. You don't have to spend every last dime you have. But that said, I'm fascinated by the questions that they've got in front of them with their own free agents, because they've got those two guys, but then they've also got two guys that have the option of coming back or testing the market with Aflalo and Williams. And what I could very easily see happening is them having to make kind of a decision about some of these guys and some of the guys that might be flashier, like Derek Williams, versus someone who's really, really consistent and really reliable, like a Lance Thomas. And granted, like you said, with the bird rights, they can bring him back. It's just a question of when they do it and at what number and what have you, and how much of the rest of their cap space is taken. But I find it hard to believe that they would let Lance walk. Fisher loves – he might literally be Fisher's favorite player on the roster. I think he kind of is emblematic of what the team stands for in terms of work ethic, in terms of the way he carries himself, in terms of the consistency, in terms of the fact that he's versatile and does, you know, he's kind of more of a Phil-type defender in terms of being able to guard multiple positions on the wing, not nearly as well as Pippen did, but like that same sort of defender where you can kind of interchange him. He's guarded everyone from James Harden to Kevin Durant to different people like that. And so he's perfect for this roster. And the funny thing about Lance, and I think a lesser extent Galloway, these guys strike me as people that could be like your seventh, eighth, ninth guys off the bench on a championship caliber team.
Absolutely. I agree. As long as they keep hitting their threes, right. That's the only thing. You wonder how much of a fluke that might be. I mean, this is a Knicks team that you mentioned the defense. There are also a lot of guys who are shooting the mess out of the ball. And, you know, you wonder maybe is that going to continue, because, you know, it's probably too small of a sample size to say, all right, these guys all of a sudden are, you know, 38%, 40% three-point shooters, although it could be. We just, it's you can't be sure yet.
Yeah, no, that's huge. All that really matters because, you know, not only we've said for years, Melo needs a core around him that can shoot and can defend and kind of make up for some of the things that, you know, to make it easier for him on offense, but also to make it easier for him on defense, you know, particularly when we didn't think he was that great a defender. And this year he's played much better defensively and his effort has been better. But Lance Thomas in particular, I think someone phrased a question to him yesterday, essentially saying, you've made more threes this year than you took in your whole career this season alone. And that's a wild sort of thing to comprehend. He didn't take a single three in his career at Duke. And so he's gotten so much better offensively. Not only is he not a liability there, but he's also pretty good most nights. And he scores basically 9-10 points every night at least, without taking a whole lot of shots and without dominating the ball. So I think that they'll bring him back. I would hope that they're looking to bring back Galloway. In hindsight, these are probably guys that they should have locked up for longer. But, you know, I don't think there's any way of knowing that Lance would show this kind of improvement. And with Galloway, in his case, I think they probably had seen enough last year to maybe where they could have offered him a longer deal. You know, I'm a critic of those Philly deals just from – like a human.
Well, yeah, you know what? Actually, I don't think that they could have at the time because I think all they had was the veteran exception, and that can only be for or the veteran's minimum exception, and that can only be for 2 years. They would have had to break into some other exception once you're capped out. So I don't think they actually could have offered him a longer deal than that because when they signed those guys, they were over the cap.
That's
so
a good point. Yeah, I keep forgetting their cap situation changed by so much over the course of when they got those two.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, they both are good enough players, and they know the system at this point. They both play hard on both sides of the floor. They do enough of the things that I think you want. Like I was saying, I really do think they could potentially be championship-caliber role players. It's just that they don't have the stars that you need yet to fill out the rest of the roster. You might have one or two of them, but you probably need one or two more, and you definitely need help in the backcourt before you could really consider this a contender. But I like those two, and I definitely see the Knicks making a real effort to try to bring them back, but it might be very similar to what you said. It might be after they get a sense of who all they can get, you know, in terms of the big-name free agents first, or even the mid-level free agents before they bring those guys back. Because I think Lance in particular, he's probably found a comfort zone. He's not going to find a team that falls more in love with him than the Knicks are right now. And I think they'll probably take care of him at this point. So it might require them doing what they did with Lopez, where they essentially get an agreement, say, just wait, and we'll take care of you once we figure out everything else.
Yeah, well, so it's going to be interesting, though, because if they do that, I mean, those guys aren't going to count. Their cap holds are pretty low. I think Lance Thomas will be about $1 million, and then Galloway, depending on you know whether he meets the starter criteria or not, I think he could be up to about $2 million. I have to go back and check exactly, but anyway, they'll be really low, and so that's all they'll count for on their books, and they could spend up to the cap, except for like that $3 million or so combined. The only problem is if you do it that way, then you're basically limited to offering each of them about $6 million to start, and if those guys keep playing that way, you know it's possible that they could actually. I mean, Galloway will be restricted, but. And they can't offer him that much more. But Thomas, if he keeps playing this way, he could actually get a deal that's more than that.
Yeah.
Like, and they could lose him if they try that. I mean, I don't think Lance Thomas is a guy to upset your entire offseason strategy for, but
well,
it's actually a slight concern.
He's been that good, though. And
he really has.
The truth is, he really could end up doing that. You know, if they aren't going to make the playoffs, I don't think the Knicks would mind him slowing down just a little, because he's been, I mean, I honestly asked this question on Twitter one day. He had the one game where I think he went 9 for 9 and then started the next game like 2 for 2 or 3 for 3. And I posed a half joking question on Twitter. I said, where does Lance Thomas rank in terms of most important players on this team? And obviously you've got Melo and you've got Porzingis at this point, but a lot of people are saying he's third, and people that weren't saying that were saying 4. And I mean, the truth is, he's really the only consistently good wing defender they have. He's really the only scorer that they have that really doesn't require anyone to get him a good look. Or, you know, he can just kind of spot up if he needs to. But yesterday, it was funny, I actually joked with him. I made a comment about how everything went to one-on-one late in the game. And I said, I think you had a look, one or two looks like that too. but you actually converted yours. I was like, so maybe you're becoming an ISO scorer as well. And he started laughing. But, I mean, he's literally had – I mean, he's probably played twice as well as what I would have expected from him. Because there are certain guys that you wonder sometimes when they're playing with a bad team like last year, even if they play well, is that really indicative of the fact that they're a good player, or is it because they can kind of take advantage of a situation where no one else can really do anything? And certain guys stand out in environments like that, and other guys really can't sustain that when they're actually playing with better talent and when they can't be the center of everything. And so Lance, he didn't necessarily strike me that way, but there were some people that did strike me that way. A lot of Knicks fans fell in love with someone like Ricky Lito, who only seemingly played well when everyone else was horrible because he could hog the ball. And so I think the beauty in Galloway and Thomas is that they're guys that play within the system and generally aren't going to hurt you because they are playing hard enough and well enough on both ends of the floor to where even if they're not shooting well, they're bringing something else to the table. And in past years, they just haven't had guys like that. They did not have nearly enough players like that between JR. Shumpert sometimes was inconsistent defensively along with bad shooting. And, you know, obviously now they have Aflalo and Calderon. So they've just had too many guys that were one-way players. And I think the fact that you have two-way players that are wings, you obviously want to keep them if you can because those guys are at a premium right now in the NBA.
They really are. If you could guarantee me that Lance, this is for real and Lance Thomas is going to play this way at least the next 2 years, that's like an $8 to $10 million a year player in this new market. Now, this is the first time, as you noted, that he's ever played like this. Gut feeling, do Aflalo and Derek Williams opt out of their deals? Let's say they just keep playing, you know, about like they've played so far this year.
Honestly, if they keep this up, I would venture to guess that Williams would opt out and Aflalo would not. I don't know that Aflalo – it's weird. And like I said, I wrote about how inconsistent he's been all year. He's had moments where he looks worth way more than $8 million. Like he has 25 – he had a 38-point game where he was 8 of 9 from 3 or 7 of 8 from 3 or whatever it was. And he essentially becomes Melo when Melo can't play some nights. And then other nights he looks way worse than someone like JR, which is just like hard to believe. And I mean, JR can be a very good player, but his shot selection is so shaky. It comes within the offense, but he prefers to take so many off-balance shots. And he's also just not – like JR actually could be a good defender when he's locked in. Aflalo, it never looks like his head is somewhere else. It's just that he physically isn't that great laterally, and he gets hung up on screen so frequently that when you put the Knicks in pick and rolls between him and Calderon, it's like you can pretty much get wherever you want. And he's physical enough to stop someone from backing him down, but he's not good at getting around people. If he were to keep up what he's doing, and let's say that he plays well for the next 2 weeks, but then struggles for the rest of the year, you know, which essentially is kind of what he's done. He's had like one good month, one bad month. If he does that for the rest of the year, I think what he's making now is about what he's worth, because he's only going to get worse from here, you would think, at age 30. Derek Williams is a totally different case because I think he's only 24 or 25. So I think Williams has shown enough, and he's had enough good moments in this market, and I think in the system, to where he deserves more money than that with the way the cap is going to go up. And I think he could get more money, even if it's to come back with the Knicks. I think he could get that kind of money somewhere else.
Yeah, I think Aflalo will opt out because, as you mentioned, he's 30, and I think he still, you know, can probably get about $8 million a year. I think he's sort of a guy who, you know, can be like a combo wing, guard twos or threes, more off the bench, hidden open three. You know, that's still something that he's good at. If you get him on a team where he's not going to be, you know, doing as much sort of back to the basket, isolating post-ups, and he doesn't have to guard the absolute best guy, you know, I think he could be effective. I mean, I don't think he's going to get more on a per year basis, but just because he only has 1 year left and this is such an overheated market, I could see him opting out. So that's why I think that he will, but not that he's going to get some enormous raise, but maybe just lock in for more years. And I agree with you about D Will too. He started off so well in preseason in the first couple games, and then he sort of was out of the rotation for a while, and now he's back actually playing well. He had his own 30-point game lately. So and I mean, how has his defense been this year?
I'll put it this way. when you see tweets about him playing well, it's never because of that. I mean, and I think that's honestly why you saw him off the floor. Fisher never threw him under the bus. He was shooting poorly too. And the guy, I mean, he's actually as inconsistent as Aflalo is to some extent. When you look at how he shot, his splits are some of the most bizarre splits I've seen. Like, Aflalo's are bad because he shoots. I had this in my story the other day. Aflalo shoots better than J.J. Redick from three in their wins, but then shoots worse from three than Kobe in the Knicks' losses. And then if you look at Derek Williams' numbers, his numbers look like that on the road versus the home splits. And so he's been pretty inconsistent. He had a month where he shot less than 30%, I think, and then, you know, lately has been up closer to 50% and is scoring a ton. But his defense has been pretty either bad or okay. And I think that's where Fisher, you see him reward the guys really consistently who he feels like give consistent effort and play good defense regardless of whether they're scoring. And I think that's why you see so much of Galloway and Thomas and why, you know, Thomas, he essentially was considering, you know, starting him for a while before they realized that Aflalo was going to be out for so long. That, you know, I think he was giving thought to that. That's what I was hearing, is that he was giving thought to the idea of starting him before they knew. They went with Vujicic, obviously, and they probably should have gone with Lance Thomas, but he respects Lance Thomas that much, and he just respects his ethic, his work ethic. And so I think that's what you see, is that Derek Williams doesn't play enough defense consistently to be in the lineup all the time, especially when he's not scoring well. So that's why you don't really hear much about him getting a whole lot more playing time than what he has, even though he clearly has a skill set in terms of getting to the basket and picking up the tempo, which they obviously need to do. That's why he doesn't get much more playing time. He has been rebounding really well lately, though. That's something that he wasn't doing before. He's had a couple games now where he's been in double-digit rebounding.
Yeah, and at least if you're playing him and Lance Thomas together off the bench, you could do some switching between those two guys. I mean, they're both sort of combo forward types who can at least passably guard, you know, threes or fours. But you mentioned Fisher a lot. What do you think of the job that he has done this year? He's seems to come under fire a lot just due to some choices in his rotation and their late game offense being a little stagnant. But I think he's actually been pretty darn good.
I think he's had really good stretches. I think January has been a lot better for him. I didn't think yesterday was one of his greatest performances. I don't really think he tells guys. I mean, no one's going to tell a guy to stop shooting, but I don't think he set them up very well in that game. He also didn't have Lopez on the floor. I think they're up by four with about 45 seconds or a minute left and didn't put Lopez on the floor for defensive purposes, which would have made sense.
And they gave up a key offensive rebound that let the Thunder get back from a 4-point deficit with like a minute left. So yeah, that hurt.
Right. So there are mistakes like that. He's made mistakes like that a couple times where at the end of a game he doesn't make a defensive sub the way he should. I actually remember last year a game in Charlotte, I think it was, where Kemba Walker got a game-winning layup and he left Tim Hardaway Jr. and Amari Stoudemire on the court and left Shumpert and D'Alembert on the bench for a game losing possession, literally with the clock expiring. The clock expired on that play. And I remember asking him, why did you do that? Or like, what was your mindset there? He's like, well, Tim and Amari got us back in the game. It's like, well, yeah, but that was from like an offensive perspective.
Yeah, that always kills me.
You don't make a decision to win or lose a game based on like whether someone, not on a single play, like a last play. Like I understand leaving them in for a stretch toward the end, but not, you put your absolute best defenders in the game for a last play. So he's done some things like that. I did highlight earlier in the month, I thought he was doing really well. He finally trimmed his rotation, which is something that Phil frequently did, where he would go the first 2 months of the season and let essentially everybody get to play from time to time. And then as the season would go on, he kind of finalized everything and trimmed the rotation and find the guys he wanted. But he gave everybody a chance at first, and Fisher did that too. He finally trimmed the rotation to about 9 guys after having it really at 12 and 13 for most of the season. And it immediately started paying dividends. He did what I was saying before with KP and Lopez and finding a way to sub them both in so that one of them was on the court all the time, which is a challenge when you start them both together. And so I gave him credit for that. And also just analyzing the statistics out of their timeouts, they had gone from 37% the first month scoring out of timeouts to 47% of the time scoring out of timeouts in, I think, December. And then once you got to January, at least when I wrote the story, they're up around 63 or 64. Yeah.
And that's actually really good because after timeouts are just about the lowest percentage chance that you have of scoring of any situation.
Right. And so they're doing an excellent job with that. I'm sure it's coming back down to earth a little bit since I wrote the story, but I think he's done a much better job this month. I had a lot of questions in the first 2 months because I just didn't understand the idea of the rotation. I really still don't understand Vujicic and why you would play him a lot more than Grant in certain situations. It seemed like he would yo-yo O'Quinn and Serafin, and he really didn't know which one of those guys he wanted to back up KP and Lopez. I think, honestly, I overheard him having a conversation in Miami. I quoted him on this. I thought it was fascinating. He basically said, someone asked, what's the biggest difference in year one to year two for you other than the improved roster? And he basically said, I didn't really have the balls to pull guys in the first year or to not play them in the short in my rotation because I was still so new to this and I wanted all the players to like me. And I've realized I can't really worry about that now. And so that's kind of the difference I've seen from year one to year two is that he's bench guys. You know, he pulls guys out of the game, and I think it's a positive step. But I would still harp. I was on a radio interview this morning, and someone asked me, the Knicks had a really good loss last night. And I was like, yeah, but after a while, you got to start winning some of these games. I know no one expects you to beat KD and Westbrook in a game without Melo, but they have lost by all five of the games that Melo hasn't played in at this point. And four of those five, they had the lead in the final 5 minutes of the game. And they've actually been tied or had the lead in all five of those games to start the fourth quarter. So I think at some point you do, when you get to the end of the season, if they finish with 36 or 37 wins and come up one or two wins short of the playoffs, people are going to look back at those games and say they probably could have made it had they just finished those games off, even if Melo was there. And some of that does come down to coaching, quite frankly. So I think he's done much better this year than he did last year. There's some things you can really point to and say he's really tangibly fixed, but I do think that there's still some areas of improvement for him.
You know, to me, all of those things I think are very valid criticisms, and those are the things that, including, the Twitterverse, guys like me like to harp on during the games and people like to go crazy about. But overall, I think this roster, when you consider the individual talent, you've got a rookie big man, you've got Jose Calderon and Aaron Aflalo as your starting backcourt, and Sasa Vujicic when it wasn't Aflalo. you've got Melo, who has never really defended before. Robin Lopez is probably just an average defensive center overall. And yet they've been pretty much mid-pack this year in defense after being one of the worst in the league last year. I think that to me, trumps any of the other stuff, and I think that it's hard to conclude. I mean, now, you don't know what's going on internally. Maybe it's an assistant who deserves a lot of the credit for that. But generally, I mean, if you're going to just give credit to the head coach for a certain performance, I think that has been most impressive. And I think this team has really outperformed its talent level, and he's also provided a good environment for Porzingis to develop. So I think it's really difficult to say, even with some of those in-game foibles, that he's not doing a good job this year.
No, I completely agree with you. I wrote a story the other day laying out that maybe the biggest step forward for them as an organization is that, assuming that Lopez and Porzingis are going to be here, they have a defensive system that I think can work. I mean, we talk about the triangle, and I said, I'd really like to see the triangle with them having a legitimate point guard that can create his own shot and get to the basket. We're watching their defense do okay without any real backcourt stoppage at all, which is impressive. You know, they've done pretty well guarding the perimeter this year, and they've been really good at the rim. They have really good rim protection, and they are doing it with a different sort of system. Playing with 2 7-footers is really rare. And today's NBA to do it consistently and to do it for the majority of the minutes. And it's worked. And I think, Fisher came in saying very clearly, this is what I want to do. This is how I want our defense to look. And I think the system works. And I think it's something that they can actually build on for the next few years until they figure out what's going to happen with Lopez or until his contract is out. So I really like that element of it. And yeah, like you said, whether it's Fisher or someone else, the organization really does deserve some credit. I've harped on them about this in the past, with the lack of development, the lack of keeping draft picks long-term. You know, they've only re-signed one player over the last 20 or 25 years to a multi-year deal that they took in the first round, and that's Charlie Ward. you know, and so they really are developing a couple guys. We talk about Lance Thomas. We talk about Galloway. We talk about Porzingis and the fact that he didn't even look this good in summer league. I'm sure he was better than what we knew, but at the same time, he's also played really well and gotten a lot better in a short amount of time than I think what even they thought he was. So they deserve credit on all those fronts, whether it's Fisher specifically or whether it's his staff and the organization. They definitely deserve credit, and I think he does deserve some credit for that, no doubt.
Well, it's interesting. I noticed when they were here last year, Oklahoma City, seeing them in person before the game, they, to me, have the sort of most impressive warm-up. And for those who don't get to games early, usually the guys who aren't playing, they'll go through warm-ups. You know, there wasn't really a chance to get a sweat going, so they'll do a pretty hard workout for 30 minutes or so, try to stay in shape. You know, if you're not playing regularly, that can be difficult. Just try to do some player development stuff. Oklahoma City, to me, has sort of the most regimented, most realistic, best way of doing that, you know, with kind of the most people involved, doing a ton of corrective exercises, great skill development. They just look like very organized, very impressive in the way they do that. And then when the Knicks came in last year, even though, you know, it was a horrendous team, I saw them doing very similar. And Fisher came from Oklahoma City. I would imagine that there's that influence. I think he brought some people with him from Oklahoma City as well. You're there all the time. What are your thoughts on that? Maybe that's something that has to do with the way that some of these guys have developed.
Yeah, no, I actually talked to Derek about some of that. Not specifically to that point, but about some of that. And was kind of blown away by some of the stuff he was telling me. I wrote a story over the summer about the fact that he was giving out books to some of the young players. And, you know, that obviously follows a longstanding Phil Jackson tradition as well. But I remember asking him, what does he really give people to read about? Or why does he give them certain books to read about? And what do those books really entail? And he said a lot of it goes to fitness, and that he's really big on the idea. One of the things he was most proud of as a longstanding veteran was the fact that he's kept himself in such good shape and was able to play as long as he was. And that's something that he's really big on in terms of trying to pass that on to other players. And, you know, he told me even with other players on his other teams, with Lamar Odom, he said he always would give him stuff to read and look at in terms of just staying in decent shape. And so Fisher, I have no doubt that there's, you know, a big part of Fisher that that really emphasizes that. And some of the people he's brought on the staff, he obviously has one assistant that came from Oklahoma City, but I think he also – I think there was one other person that he brought onto the staff this year that I'm trying to remember exactly. I think he's just a development coach or something along those lines, that I think he brought him as well. So there probably was something that Fish saw with that he took to or that he appreciated, that I think he wanted part of what the Knicks were doing. But I'm curious about whether they've changed over some of their med staff, because they've been really healthy this year. I think part of that is – the fact that they've got a much younger roster. They've got much younger guys, at least. I think the average age is probably not that far off from what it was.
Not having Amari Stoudemire on the team probably helped a little bit with that.
So part of it was that. Part of it was obvious. But a lot of the guys they brought on have had injury problems before. Like I said at the top, with Calderon and Lopez and several other guys. But the other people, you know, they haven't really been dinged up with injuries yet. And I think that's going to be a huge part of their playoff chase. So I'm curious to see how it works.
All right, so last topic here. First of all, you know, the trade deadline and free agency. First of all, do you foresee them making much of a mark in trade talks? You know, there's this Jeff Teague thing. I don't see what they have to trade for Teague, frankly. But I mean, that, and Danny and I did a podcast talking about their trade deadline. Do you foresee them doing anything? And if so, what might that be?
I mean, obviously, if they're going to, the two areas that they could really use somebody are point guard, and that's far and away the thing they need most. And obviously they could use another wing stopper, because they really went on a slide there when Lance Thomas was hurt with the knee injury. And they really don't have many players that can make a stop defensively if he's not there. But I don't know what's out there. I don't know really what they could get without having to give up too much. They don't have enough assets to where they can just be giving away draft picks to get somebody. And the truth is, unless you're giving up on someone really early, like, you know, like a Jaren Grant or someone along those lines, or if you do part ways with Galloway or a Lance Thomas, which I would think they would not want to do that, because at this point these are essentially homegrown guys that they've kind of built up a little bit, that they've invested in, and also are on great value deals that they have the rights to try to keep them longer term. I don't know what else you're going to, you know, unless you mortgage your future by giving up one of the picks in 2018, I don't know what they have to offer. They have big men, but, you know, let's say you want to make the deal for Teague. Atlanta doesn't really need big men. I had people tweeting at me today when I said that,
yeah,
saying, well, Atlanta's horrible at rebounding. Well, they were bad in rebounding last year too, but that's not what they emphasize over there. And they emphasize being able to space the floor, to be able to move the ball and get ball and guys that fit their system. And so I really don't see, you know, they're not going to take Kevin Serafin over there. There's no need for that. And also the Knicks would have to give up either a draft pick or Grant or someone like that. And I don't understand what the point in doing that would be. Essentially, Teague's not a rental, but I think he's only on the books for one more year.
Yeah.
It's not like a long-term sort of thing that you'd be keeping him for. So if you're not getting that in return, I wouldn't be willing to give up that much. Schroeder would make way more sense, but he probably would cost them even more, and they just don't have those sorts of assets to give up. So I don't really know who they're going to be able to get, but I think this is a chance for them to really make a mark and really stand firm and say we're not going to mortgage everything we have to make a 1 or 2 year run at this, especially when you finally have a window, whether it's Melo's window or not, we don't know, but you finally have a window with Porzingis that you should be able to really do something and contend. If you hit on one other draft pick maybe, and you use the money that you've got in free agency and get someone who's not right at the end of their career, you should be able to make a pretty solid run here 2-3 years from now. And I would hate to see them give away a pick where you really would have wanted to use it 2 years from now, because I really think that they actually have the makings of something, but not if they continue to give away picks the way they've done in the past.
You know, I think going into free agency as well, I agree with you that I wouldn't want to give up a ton here. And, you know, that 2016 pick is traded away unprotected to Toronto. And, you know, so the first pick they could trade would be 2018. Anyway, I think that, let's say, obviously you go after the biggest guys, you know, the Horford, Conley, maybe even Nick Batum is someone that you might be willing to pay for. Durant, obviously.
I'd love to see Batum, yeah.
Yeah. You know, but assuming you don't hit on those guys, then I feel like the way to go is maybe somewhat similar to what they did last summer, but say, all right, you know, we're going to maybe be okay overpaying for a guy or two, but let's have it be short term. And then really, to me, and you kind of do as well as you can with Melo these next couple of years, maybe, you know, he still has that no trade clause. Maybe if you don't really get into the playoffs again, you might look to move him and cut some more salary at the end of his deal. And then to me, the time to strike is 2018. And that's for two reasons. One is that'll be Porzingis's third year. That'll be the last year that he's on the books at that low rookie salary before he'll require an extension. Or maybe 2019, you could sort of do the Kawhi Leonard Andre Drummond hold off on signing him and then use his smaller cap hold assuming that doesn't get changed in the next CBA. But so one of those years. And then also the other thing that I like about that 2018 year is there's sort of going to be this bonanza these next 2 years, 2016 and then maybe 2017 as well, if the cap continues to go up, depending on what happens with the CBA, where everybody's going to have cap space. And so they're going to use all of it up, and you're going to have a ton of competition. But then once you get into 2018 and 2019, the cap's not going to be going up as much, presumably, because the new TV money will have kicked in.
Right.
And then it'll kind of be back to the way it used to be, where, you know, less teams had cap room. So if you can engineer, this goes for any team, really, if you can engineer it to have more room in those years, maybe your dollars go a little bit further.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying, is that the Knicks are never, ever used to being in a position where they have money and other teams don't. You know, they seem to have money in the years where everybody's competing. You know, the year where everyone wants LeBron in 2010, or these other sorts of scenarios. And wouldn't it be nice for them to actually be the rare team that can step in and say, we've actually got the money to spend here, and we've got a star young player, you know? And by that point, you know, Carmelo, like you said, they might have to figure out what direction they're going to go with him at that point. But even, you know, aside from that, Porzingis has a chance to be a better player in terms of where he stands in relation to the rest of the league than Melo is right now. I mean, that's just the reality of it, I think, is that we don't really know what his ceiling is just yet. He obviously needs to develop some other types of skills. He needs to be able to run an offense by himself or lead an offense where he's the lead guy, and that's something that we know Melo has been able to do. But I think we've kind of seen the ceiling of that, where if Melo's your best offensive player, your best player, what that tops out at. We don't know that of Porzingis yet. And so, you know, who knows what he'll help you attract. Or, you know, if the Knicks continue to steadily improve, what sorts of players might want to be part of a more winning environment than what they've seen so far. And when you have, if you have a lot of cap space, maybe you can go get two guys instead of just one and you get a package deal with someone. There's so many possibilities, but again, those possibilities aren't open if you blow all your money, particularly in a year where everyone else is doing that too. If you're not going to get your guy or get someone that you really feel like makes you better quickly, then it really might not be the worst move to just wait and to kind of sit there until you really strike at the right opportunity and make the most use of your money.
Yeah, I'm not saying don't spend that money at all if you strike out on the big guys. I'm saying do it in a way that you're protecting flexibility for a couple of years. I think, you know, if Porzingis continues to develop, if you can retain some of these guys from this team, you could realistically be kind of a lower rung playoff team in the East for the next couple of years. And then, you know, once Melo is kind of in the twilight, but Porzingis is really starting, I mean, you know, you hope that he gets to this point, that starting to become a superstar, you know, in year three for him, 22, 23, then you can really kind of reload when it's clear that it's not going to be Melo's team anymore. Because I don't see them trading Melo anytime soon, do you?
No. I think any conversation of that went out the window with the kind of start they had and the fact that, quite frankly, and I was even talking to KP about this yesterday, Melo really likes Porzingis. And, you know, I don't know.
Everyone seems to.
Yeah, I don't know that was instantly true the moment he was drafted. And it's, you know, it's kind of become a touchy subject. But I asked Carmelo, you know, the other day, I said, you know, you guys are doing well. Now you're at 500. Just be honest, like, when did you really realize that the timeline that was talked about by analysts and even kind of hinted at by Phil, that this project, so to speak, was not going to take as long to get off the ground as what people thought? And he said, when we really started working out and I saw all the things he could do, I realized that it's not going to take him that long to pick up everything. And so Melo, I mean, even little stuff you kind of pick up on, the fact that Melo stands next to the kid every single time the national anthem is sung. Like, he's really taking this guy under his wing. I don't know if people see that from the outside, but he really likes him, and it's really hard not to with how well he's played, but also just kind of how cheerful a spirit he has in the locker room. So he doesn't want out at this point. And I think, yeah, hopefully people see that, but he has a no trade. And so if he doesn't want out, he's not going to get dealt. And, you know, I could not really imagine him unless something really drastic happened. Maybe KP gets hurt or has a really serious run of injuries or something, and then it ends up bottoming out the team because Melo's going into his twilight years. I can't really see why Melo would want to leave unless he just becomes dead set on a title before he retires and realizes it's not going to happen with the Knicks. But short of that, I don't think he wants out now, and I don't really see at this point with the kind of trajectory they're on, with the space they're going to have, and the possibilities they have in terms of trades and stuff like that, I don't quite see why he would want out at this point.
All right, well, we're going to actually end a Knicks podcast on a positive note. When's the last time that anyone could have said that before this year? So thanks so much for coming on, Chris. Anything you've written lately that people should check out in the Knicks that want to hear a little bit more?
No, nothing too big. I'll probably do some stuff. I was mentioning the injuries before. I'll probably do something longer on what the second half of their season might look like or what to expect from an injury standpoint or what they're going to try to avoid from an injury standpoint since they were so healthy the first half of the season. But that'll be out later this week. Nothing today or nothing yesterday or anything like that.
And where can we follow you on Twitter?
I'm at HerringWSJ on Twitter.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Also, check out our awesome sponsors. That's always appreciated to keep us on the air, or an iTunes rating or review also has been instrumental in our success, and we really appreciate those as well. So that'll do it for today. We will talk to y'all next time.